from the JAMA Network. This is the JAMA Pediatrics Editor's Summary, a discussion of the most important articles published in the latest issue of JAMA Pediatrics.
Hello again, podcast listeners. This is Dimitri Christakis, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA Pediatrics, here with our monthly podcast. And as is now the case, I am joined by my close friend, colleague, and associate editor, the eminent Dr. Allison Galbraith, joining me from Harvard Pilgrim.
Hi, good to be with you.
We have two papers to discuss. Allie, you want to go first?
Yeah, so I have a paper called Association Between High Need Education-Based Funding Support and School Suspension for Autistic Students by Nicholas Bowden and colleagues at the University of Otago in New Zealand. And I just want to preface this by saying that I'm going to be talking about the paper using language that the authors have chosen to use to refer to autistic patients rather than person-first language based on the preference of some people in the community.
Thanks for pointing that out, Allie.
So they wanted to know if school suspension rates differed between autistic and non-autistic students, and if high-need education-based funding support was associated with lower suspension rates. And what they mean by high-need education-based funding support is a program in New Zealand where children who have substantial, complex, ongoing levels of need, for example, in learning, hearing, vision, physical or language use, or social communication, they can qualify for individual funding based on their individual needs. So it's not funding allocated to a school or to a region, it's for an individual.
It follows the child.
Yeah, it follows the child, and it goes towards things like teacher aids or specialist support or things like that. And so the reason they did this study is that kids with autism have high rates of educational difficulties, and school exclusion in this population has been linked to poor academic achievement. And so suspension, the hypothesis is that it would be detrimental. And so they wanted to know if the high needs education funding support might reduce those rates and ultimately help these kids educationally. So they did a national retrospective cohort study, and they took advantage of a great resource, which was linked health and education data from New Zealand. So it's national data. They identified over 736,000 students. They were 5 to 16 years of age. This is in 2018. And then of those, there were about 9,700 who they identified as having autism based on a couple different national health data sets. One had hospitalization data, one had mental health services. And then they had data from the Ministry of Education to see if they had been suspended. And basically they adjusted for socioeconomic status and the level of need of the child and other co-occurring conditions. And what they found was that 5.2% of autistic children were suspended versus 1.9% of non-autistic students. So quite a big difference.
Yeah, stop right there, Allie. I mean, that alone, right? I mean, gives one pause because kids need to be in school and children with autism don't need to be in school any less than children without autism.
Right, for sure. And that's not a totally new finding, but still very striking. And that persisted after adjustment for other covariates. The odds were 2.81 times higher that they'd be suspended than non-autistic children. But then when they looked at the receipt of the high need funding, they found that 2.0% of those with the high need funding had suspensions versus 6.5% without the funding. That was an odds ratio of 0.29 and significant. So their conclusion was that, well, obviously there's disparities in suspension.
Even with the funding, right?
But the funding seemed to make a difference, right? And so they can have lower suspension rates, preventing something that might impede them from getting an adequate and inclusive education. And they were talking about that this extra funding can help teachers manage challenging behaviors or deter bullying or things that might end up leading to suspension.
One of the questions that always arises is how do we extrapolate from effective studies done in other populations? I don't mean autistic populations, I mean other countries. Do you have any thoughts on that? Our educational system, even pre-pandemic, has not been doing a very good job serving children with special needs. What can we learn from this, if anything, and what can pediatricians do?
It's hard to know what the pediatricians can do because this is a solution that's outside of direct patient care, which is great. You can reach a lot of kids if you try to intervene at school. And they talked about this program, they have funding, but, you know, it's not perfect. It's not infinite funding. And you could reach more children if you were able to expand it or have more funding. We have programs to provide services in schools. They're probably set up a little bit differently. But one interesting point that they made in their discussion as they were talking about where we need to do further research, they talked about the need to see if something like high need education-based funding could be associated with reduction in ethnic disparities in suspension. I think they see that as well in New Zealand. And so I think that is a really important question for future research.
Well, you know, it's nice to see a situation where adding resource actually does make a difference. And of course, that then begs the cost effectiveness. But obviously, that was outside of scope of this. But reduced suspensions in early education pays huge lifelong dividends. So it's not hard to believe that any of these early interventions that improve school attendance, school performance, won't pencil out over the long term.
Right. As the authors pointed out, there's already problems with educational development for kids with autism based on school exclusion. And so the more we can keep kids in school and not suspended, the better.
The second paper we have to discuss is developmental outcomes for children after elective birth at 39 weeks gestation. This study is actually out of Australia. And they start by talking about the ARRIVE trial. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, the acronym stands for a randomized trial of induction versus expectant management. This was a study published actually in 2018. And it looked at the safety of elective induction of labor at 39 weeks compared to expectant management. And the idea here was to study actually in a randomized controlled trial whether or not inducing labor at 39 weeks was better than just letting nature take its course. And what they found was there was no increased risk of cesarean section or perinatal complications by inducing labor, which makes, I guess, some amount of sense because we know that extending gestation past term is associated with increased risks. And so inducing labor at term or at about term is reasonable. But as the authors point out, that study only looked at perinatal outcomes and didn't look at longer term outcomes, which one might imagine might be affected by inducing labor. So not so much perinatal outcomes, but developmental outcomes later in life. And as they also point out, using a randomized experimental approach to such a study would be, to say the least, cumbersome because you would have to replicate the ARRIVE study, but then follow all of these kids for 4 to 6 years and do comprehensive assessments of them developmentally with a fair degree of granularity to see whether or not there were differences. At JAMA Pediatrics, we always ask ourselves, before we take an observational study, is this an observational study that could have been done as a randomized controlled trial? These authors make the point that you really couldn't feasibly do a randomized controlled trial of that.
Yeah, that would be hard.
So they did a population-based cohort study linking perinatal data in Victoria, Australia, from January 2005 to 2013 with 2018 Australian early developmental census data. I guess periodically in Australia, they do these comprehensive assessments of children when they're 4 to 6 years of age, looking at a whole set of domains related to child development and come up with a sort of global developmental vulnerability assessment. Using that approach to try in an observational way to see whether or not there was risks associated with either induction or expectant labor. And then they did a separate study to look at whether or not planned C-section versus induction of labor at 39 weeks made a difference.
One of the challenges with this type of research previously is that you can't tell if a C-section is planned or unplanned. And they seem to be able to know that or to know an induction was planned or not.
I guess their information systems are better than what we typically have here. And of course, there still could be some level of misclassification. So it's a good point, Allie. When you compared expectant management versus elective birth at 39 weeks, global developmental vulnerability, so all of their domains together, came up with an adjusted relative risk of 1.03 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.96 to 1.12. And this was also basically the case when you looked at planned C-section versus not, with a adjusted odds ratio of 0.96 and a confidence interval of 0.82 to 1.12 across all of the individual domains. And we published a study, and I think it's important because it provides additional reassurance with longer-term outcome that inducing labor 39 weeks is safe. But one might ask, that confidence interval doesn't rule out the possibility that there's a small increased elevated risk. The point estimate was 1.03. The 95% confidence interval clearly included one and went from 0.96 to 1.12. On the one hand, there's no significant increase. On the other hand, if you look at the confidence interval, it's consistent with the possibility that there's minimal decreased risk and possibly increased risk. But this included 176,000 births. So one of the struggles, which they point out, you could never do a randomized controlled trial. It'd be pretty hard to do a larger study. So I don't know what your thoughts on that are, Ali. You know, we published it as a significant negative reassuring study. One might say, gee, are you really positive that this excludes the possibility of a small increased risk, which may be what the truth is?
Right, but it's not so wide that it includes a really concerning large effect either. I appreciated that it would be hard to do this as a randomized trial, and they used really sophisticated methods for an observational study to try to causally interpret these effects. And I think it's sort of the best we could do.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I should point out that the risk also could in fact be protective. So I think for our obstetric colleagues and for the mothers, I guess it would be probably the mothers of our second patients, since we wouldn't probably be seeing them when they're expecting their first, we can offer some reassurance around inducing labor at 39 weeks.
That's an important clinical question.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to thank all of you once again for listening to our podcast. This particular episode was produced by Shelley Steffens at the JAMA Network. The audio team here also includes Jesse McPorters, Daniel Morrow, Lisa Harden, Audrey Foreman, and Mary Lynn Furkeluk. Dr. Robert Golub is Executive Deputy Editor. To follow this and other JAMA Network podcasts, please visit us online at jamanetworkaudio.com. You can also follow this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. See you next month.